Hi folks, can we all just quiet down a little bit? Well, I want to thank you on behalf of the Lawrence Debate Union for coming to this year's public debate. Anybody who's interested in any facet of debate, we have public debates, we also have competitive debates, and you'll see people walking around in blue sweatshirts like Justin's wearing, and those are people who can be identified as debate team members, and they can help you if you have any questions. Also, we're starting a citizens debate league where people in the community can come together and debate about different issues that they feel pertinent to them. Our first citizen debate league meeting will be on Friday the 30th at 5 p.m. That's not this Friday, but a week from Friday, if you're interested in that. Also, there are people at the doors who will be handing out debate team information if anybody's interested in the debate team, and I'm also going to pass this around. And if you're in any way interested in any facet of debate, even if you're not experienced or you don't know anything about debate, if you just put your name and your email address, somebody will be in touch with you about how you can get involved in any small or large facet of debate. So I'll put this around. So tonight's debate, I'm sure you guys have all seen all the advertisement. The resolution per se is that the United States should or should not be the cops of the world. The affirmative team is made up of Professor Will Miller and the debater Justin Carmet. And negating the resolution will be Professor Robert Kaufman and student Robert Compran. Now, for those of you who haven't been to public debates, we're going to do debate parliamentary style, which means that each team will get three speeches. The affirmative team will get the first constructive speech, then the negative team will get a constructive speech, then the affirmative, then the negative. Then each team will have a rebuttal period. The only rules in this debate is that you remain to the time constrictions. I will announce the amount of time before each person gets up to speak. So the first speech is 7 minutes, and the rest of them are 8, and then the last two speeches are 4 and 5 minutes each. Each team will have 8 minutes prep time, and I'll keep prep time. They can use it however they want throughout the time. The only rules are that they can't introduce new arguments in rebuttals, and they must stop when their time is over. So if their time is over, and I say that their time is over, and they have not stopped, you should feel free as the audience to heckle them or do anything that you want to get them to stop speaking. That's about it. So I guess we can start the debate. The first speaker will be Professor Will Miller.
Tonight's debate has gained added urgency since we planned this event over a month ago because of the two wars the U.S. government is now waging simultaneously against Iraq and Yugoslavia. The proposition that the U.S. is the policeman of the world is misconceived. To be a police power, you need the recognition of and accountability to the community being policed. Without these preconditions, the police turn into an occupying or invading army. We need only recall the behavior of the police in the ghettos of America to see the truth of this claim. So to call the U.S. the policeman of the world is a misleading, even Orwellian euphemism for the reality of U.S. imperialism. Of the various notions about imperialism circulating today in the United States, the dominant one is that it no longer exists. Imperialism is not recognized as a legitimate concept, certainly not in regard to the United States. One may speak of Soviet imperialism or 19th century British imperialism, but not of U.S. imperialism. A graduate student in political science at most universities in this country would not be granted the opportunity to research U.S. imperialism on the grounds that such an undertaking would not be scholarly. So tonight we'll introduce the term and broaden the universe of discourse. If we define imperialism as that relationship in which one country dominates through the use of its economic and military power, the land, labor, resources, finances, and politics of another country, then the United States is the greatest imperial power in history. The American empire is of a magnitude never before seen, with military bases that ring the entire globe, a nuclear overkill capacity of 8,000 strategic and 22,000 tactical nuclear weapons, a fleet larger in total tonnage and firepower than all the other navies of the world combined, consisting of missile cruisers, nuclear submarines, nuclear aircraft carriers, destroyers, and spy ships that sail every ocean and make port on every continent. With only 5% of the world's population, the U.S. expends one-third of the world's military spending. Since World War II, the U.S. government has given over $200 billion in military aid to train, equip, and subsidize more than 2.3 million troops and internal security forces in some 80 countries. The purpose not being to defend themselves from outside invasion, but to protect ruling oligarchs and multinational corporate investors from the dangers of domestic anti-capitalist insurgency. Among the recipients have been such notorious military autocracies some of the most notorious military autocracies in history, countries that have tortured, killed, or otherwise maltreated large numbers of their citizens because of their dissenting political views, as in Turkey, Zaire, Chad, Pakistan, Morocco, Indonesia, Honduras, Peru, Colombia, El Salvador, Haiti, Cuba under Batista, Nicaragua under Somoza, Iran under the Shah, the Philippines under Marcos, and Portugal under Salazar. The U.S. professes a dedication to democracy, yet over the past five decades, democratically elected reformist governments were overthrown by pro-capitalist militaries that were funded and aided by the U.S. national security state in such countries as Guatemala, Iran under Mossadegh, Guyana, the Dominican Republic, Brazil, Chile, Uruguay, Syria, Indonesia under Sukarno, Greece, Argentina, Bolivia, Haiti, and numerous other nations. The U.S. national security state has participated in covert actions or proxy mercenary wars against revolutionary governments in Cuba, Angola, Mozambique, Ethiopia, Portugal, Nicaragua, Cambodia, East Timor, Western Sahara, and elsewhere, usually with dreadful devastation and loss of life for indigenous populations. Hostile actions have also been directed against reformist governments of Egypt, Lebanon, Peru, Iran, Syria, Zaire, Jamaica, South Yemen, the Fiji Islands, and elsewhere. Since World War II, U.S. forces have directly invaded or launched aerial attacks against Vietnam, the Dominican Republic, North Korea, Laos, Cambodia, Lebanon, Grenada, Panama, Libya, Iraq, Somalia, Afghanistan, Sudan, and now Yugoslavia, with sowing varying degrees of death and destruction. Tallying the total death toll inflicted by U.S. armed forces or U.S.-backed surrogate forces around the world, the estimates are as follows. 3 million in Vietnam, 1 million in Cambodia, 1 million in Mozambique, 500,000 to 1 million in Indonesia, 600,000 in Angola, 300,000 in Laos, 250,000 in East Timor, 200,000 in Iraq, 200,000 in Afghanistan, 200,000 in Guatemala, for which President Clinton recently apologized, 100,000 in Nicaragua, 900,000 in El Salvador, and tens of thousands in Chile, Argentina, Zaire, Iran, Colombia, Bolivia, Brazil, Panama, Somalia, South Yemen, Western Sahara, and other countries. At least 8 million in total. This is the real holocaust of state terrorism carried out by the United States in its self-appointed role as global policeman. North America and European corporations have acquired control of more than three-fourths of the known mineral resources of Asia, Africa, and Latin America, but the pursuit of natural resources is not the only reason for capitalist overseas expansion. There is the additional need to cut production costs and maximize profits by investing in countries with a plentiful supply of cheap labor. U.S. corporate investment grew 84% between 1985 and 1990, with the most dramatic increases in the cheap labor countries like South Korea, Taiwan, Spain, and Singapore. Because of low wages, low taxes, non-existent work benefits, weak labor unions, and non-existent occupational and environmental protections, the U.S. corporate profit rates in the third world are 50% greater than in developed countries. Today, the United States is one of the foremost proponents of recolonization and the leading antagonist of revolutionary change throughout the world. Emerging from World War II relatively unscathed and superior to all other industrial countries in wealth, productive capacity, armed might, the United States became the primary purveyor and guardian of global capitalism. Judging by the size of its financial investments, the military force, judging by every imperialist standard except direct colonization, the U.S. empire is the most formidable in history, far greater than Great Britain in the 19th century or Rome during antiquity. Far from being a candidate for world policemen, the U.S. is the world's only rogue superpower.
Professor Miller, on behalf of the American public and the United States, I would like to thank you for your dictionary of atrocities on our policy. My question to you is, what do you propose as an alternative?
My proposal for an alternative is that in the case of this, the current crisis in Yugoslavia and elsewhere, that we democratize the United Nations, get rid of the Security Council, and have the General Assembly function as a global democratic institution, and that we pick people to mediate regional conflicts that have the support and admiration of the world. Someone like Nelson Mandela, who's about to leave the presidency of South Africa, could in fact serve as just such a mediator. And if the United Nations functioned as a genuinely democratic institution, it would provide an opportunity for a resolution of conflict.
Thank you for that. My question, Professor Miller, my question to you, however, is the United Nations has been around after World War II, and apparently if you look at the UN's track record of success, I fail to see any successful action on behalf of the United States without the use of the United States military, the United States economic funding, and therefore you talk about having democratizing the General Assembly. Look at Omscom in Iraq. Has that worked in taking down the weapons? Did the UN solve anything in Vietnam? Has the UN ever been able to project any force to bring about any peace except be lip serve to the global community? What do we do about the nuclear weapons and all of these technologies you talked about? How is your model regulate for that?
Well, let me suggest that the history of failure by the United Nations is largely a monument to U.S. sabotage efforts to keep the United Nations from functioning as it could and should. Let's take an example. In the mid-1980s, the Reagan administration stopped paying its dues in order to bring the UN to the verge of bankruptcy, which is where it now stands. That's a U.S. monument.
Who paid the UN? The U.S.
My argument is the antithesis of Professor Miller's. The United States indeed does need to be the world's policeman, but let me define what a policeman does, why a policeman is necessary. A good policeman doesn't intervene everywhere, but knows when and how to intervene and when not to intervene. A good policeman will intervene with consensus if possible, but by posse and unilaterally if necessary. A good policeman knows how to use force decisively to achieve ends quickly and clearly. A good policeman knows that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, that deterrence and American commitments can prevent crises from metastasizing and becoming too costly to solve, such as what happened in the 1930s when the United States retreated into isolationism and made Adolf Hitler possible. Let's also consider the historical record. Let's contrast the first 45 years of this century when the United States refused to play the world's policeman, that role, with the next 54 when the United States did. Now, the United States remained engaged in Europe after World War I. Had we not retreated into isolationism, we would not have had to fight the most costly war in history against a malignant tyranny such as Adolf Hitler's. Hitler nearly won. American statesmen learned very well after the Second World War not to make the same mistakes of the past. They knew it was an illusion that the UN or isolationism could substitute for the benign effects of American power. Faced with a Soviet empire, and as President Reagan so correctly pointed out, was truly evil and truly malignant, the United States was willing to bear the burden and pay the price. No single event over the past 50 years has contributed so significantly to the preservation and the expansion of human freedom than that triumph over the Soviet Union. In light of the history of the 20th century, in light of the benign consequences of American power for the previous 54 years, the burden of proof should be on those who argue we shouldn't be the world's policeman, and critics just can't discharge that burden. Let me make three points. One, do we have the resources to lead? Yes, we do. In the 1980s, Paul Kennedy wrote a book saying we were in inevitable decline. That's been refuted by events. In 1900, we produced 25% of the world's manufacture. We did so in 1928, 1938, 1988, and 1998. We can't do everything, but we can still do a lot. Secondly, we have the resources, but do we have the need? Yes, we do. Even in the post-Cold War world, the United States must maintain a foreign policy that is engaged, proactive, interventionist, and expensive, but far less expensive than the alternatives. We still have a vital interest, consistent with our ideals and self-interest, consistent with the ideals and self-interest of our democratic allies, to preserve and to expand the democratic zone of peace encompassed by the NATO alliance and Japan. We have a vital interest in preventing any single hostile power from dominating Europe, from preventing any single hostile power from dominating Asia, from preventing any single hostile power from dominating the Middle East. We have a vital interest in ensuring that the United States and its democratic allies will not be subject to nuclear blackmail by the rogue states that will inevitably get nuclear technology. Hence, the United States and its allies must make it a top priority to cooperate and build effective missile defense as laid out in a visionary way by President Ronald Wilson Reagan in his speech of March 23, 1983, where he laid out the Strategic Defense Initiative. What are the alternatives to American leadership that are less costly, less risky? There are none. We've heard about the United Nations. The United Nations and relying on it is a recipe for paralysis and inaction. As people who study international organization know, the United Nations are organizations like it can't keep the peace because they lack the three prerequisites necessary for an effective peacekeeper. One, enough force to keep the peace. Two, a common perception of threat. And three, a common willingness to do enough to deal with threats. As long as international relations remains an anarchic society, a self-help system, the United States is going to have to depend on itself and its democratic allies to keep order. Who are the other alternative balancers? The Europeans? We've seen how the Europeans have done alone in places like Kosovo. We've seen how Europe did without the United States between 1348 and 1948. I picked those years because in 1348, Dante Alighieri wanted European unity. So what? For the next 500 years, the Europeans kept murdering each other until the United States intervened to establish democracy and keep the peace. Therefore, if we don't want dictators opening bottles of champagne knowing that the world is up for grabs, if we don't want the Saddam Husseins, the Milosevic's of the world, the dictators in China, the paleo-communist legislators dominating the Duma in Russia to think that we are going to squander the victory that we have won so providentially for ourselves and for our allies, a victory consistent with American ideals and self-interest. Let us not squander the peace. Let us stay the course. Let me conclude Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill wrote in his magisterial history of the Second World War, the epitaph was, how the democracies, through their carelessness, unwisdom, and good nature, allowed the wicked to reign. We have not banished evil from the human breast. There is a devil always lurking around the corner, and it will require American power exercise with our allies to keep that devil at bay.
Professor Hoffman, you mentioned the U.S. intervention in Kosovo, the U.S. NATO intervention. How would you account for the legal basis for U.N. NATO activity now, given that the NATO charter is as a defensive alliance against attack from an outside power?
One, I would argue that Article 51 of the UN Charter permits this type of collective action. And I would argue that, two, NATO can certainly modify its charter by the collective action of its members. The problem with the kind of intervention in Kosovo, and I agree with you that this problem is not that we have intervened, although we can criticize the diplomacy, it's that this exercise of power has been the most bungling of any president since John Kennedy. What we need to win in Kosovo, and we can't afford to lose given NATO credibility, is American ground troops, 7th to 9th divisions, 200,000 troops, ready to march from Hungary right to Belgrade in order to remove Milosevic. Is this a good solution? No. But the alternatives are worse. NATO is the greatest peacetime alliance for good in history, and at this critical time, we cannot afford to squander its credibility on losing. And anything short of Milosevic's removal at this point with what's gone on is a loss we cannot afford.
You spoke in very confident terms about President Ronald Reagan. In 1984, an appropriately Orwellian year, the World Court ruled that the U.S. was in violation of international law in making a war on Nicaragua. As a consequence of that ruling, and the World Court was sanctioned the United Nations, the Reagan administration ignored the ruling, continued the war on Nicaragua, and refused to pay its dues, which it was required to do as a member organization to the United Nations. How would you justify that?
As usual, bravo to the giver. Let me paraphrase Winston Churchill. We should use the United Nations when possible, ignore it when necessary. You put great faith in the United Nations. I don't. This is the same United Nations that passed the resolution which the United States wisely vetoed that Zionism was racism in the 1970s. This was the same United Nations that passed that resolution while cheering Yasser Arafat coming into the UN General Assembly with a holster. This is the same United Nations in the 1970s and 80s, in the 70s, that greeted favorably Idi Amin, who murdered 300,000 of his Asian citizens and cannibalized his wife. Therefore, I do not think that the United Nations is an organization worthy of the veneration you give it.
I want to start out by talking about this so-called isolationist period that we were in the first 45 years of this century. I believe that my esteemed opponent over here has a very Eurocentric version of what isolation is. And I'm going to start out with a quote from a Major General Smedley D. Butler. He's a two-time winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor, someone that you would think would be supporting exactly what Professor Kaufman was saying. He states that war is a racket. It may seem odd for me, a military man, to adopt such a comparison. Truthfulness compels me to. I spent 33 years and 4 months in active service as a member of our country's most agile military force, the Marine Corps. And during the period, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer for capitalism. He goes on to describe a bunch of interventions that he was directly involved with and says, looking back on it, I feel I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could have done was to operate his racket in three city districts. We Marines operated on three continents. Additionally, I have a list here that y'all can take a look at later. I'm not going to read off, but over 50 interventions that we had been involved with directly, the U.S. military has been involved with between that so-called isolationist period before World War II. So I would hardly classify us as an isolationist government. Our government just didn't have the power to be all over the world quite yet. And then he goes on, the next thing they do is they give a very good definition of what a police force should be. But I ask you all, and I see no reason to assume why any of the definition that he gave for police force represents at all what our government actually does. In fact, I would like you to remember Will's definition of police force. Actually, our force is an imperialist force and a rogue superpower. Seems to be a much more accurate description of what we have been doing. He talks a little bit about the Cold War, and we were faced with a truly evil Soviet Empire, but I would argue that the United States government was just as evil of an empire, and that we, not we, our government, I mean, you can't stress that enough, was the ones that led the Cold War. The government spent, our government fueled the nuclear arms race. Additionally, they have argued that we led to the expansion of human freedoms, but our government might be rich, and there might be a few elite people that are rich, but there are many of us in this country that are still in chains today, and that is completely ignored by the opposition. He says it's our burden of proof. I believe that our entire speech, as Will's first speech and everything being presented here, is completely proving our argument true. They go on to talk about that what we've been doing has been consistent with our self-interest and the self-interest of the democratic nation. That is exactly what the problem is that we are consistent with our self-interest. We ignore the interests of all of the other nations that we're going in and dropping bombs on and killing over 8 million people in the past 50 years. I would not call that incongruence with anyone's self-interest but a few people in our government and maybe a few other governments. So that, he says that we should not be subject to nuclear annihilation, but I would argue that instead of us being subject, we have put everybody else at risk of that nuclear annihilation, and we have made all other nations subject to our nuclear threat, which we have been more than willing to use on many occasions. I'd like to go back and just highlight a couple of Will's main arguments that he was presented that did not really get effectively answered in the first speech. The first was that the U.S. federal government is not a true police force, rather they are the largest imperial nation in the world and the only rogue superpower. Additionally, he claims that we're not allowed to talk about it in our classes. Most professors will just write you off as saying that's not scholarly, that's just completely way too out there to be anything remote. Additionally, the next main point he has is that we have not had a dedication to democracy as our opponents would like you to believe. Rather, the U.S. federal government has overthrown many democratically elected governments that have been in favor of social reform in order to replace them with dictators that are favorable to the U.S. multinational corporations. The last point that Will makes is that the U.S. federal government's position of leadership since World War II has been marked by military force, bloodshed, and corporate interests. I would like to add to that list rape, nuclear proliferation, and environmental destruction. They say, can't imagine what it would be like when, without the U.S., I can't imagine it being any worse than what we have had for the past 50 years. Our government has been directly involved in hundreds of invasions over the past century, 50 of them in the so-called isolationist period. We've killed over 8 million people, many being the actual people that we were supposedly there to protect, which shows that our self-interest is why we go places, not for the interest of anyone else. Additionally, we have exploited the resources abroad, forcing other nations to maintain their status as poor nations, then labeling them as third world in order to distance ourselves from the problems in which we have created for all of these other people. Additionally, a great deal has been talked about, well, what else can be done? And they believe that the United Nations has not been effective and cannot be effective, but that completely doesn't take into account the argument that we're trying to make, that it is the Security Council and the veto power of the United States and the United States' inability to pay its dues that has prevented the United Nations from having any positive effect in any of these areas. After listening to all that the United States federal government has done, I can't imagine it being much worse. Additionally, it is our contention that we should lead the way for UN reform. If we are the leaders and we can take some kind of leadership role, then this would be a good place to go. They say that the United Nations has been ineffective, and I have from an article in the newspaper, a very small article that was in the back of the newspaper talking about the U.S. paying $40 million towards past UN dues. It may sound like a good thing, but in actuality, the quote states, the United States has paid $40 million towards its delinquent UN dues of $521.9 million, giving the world body enough cash to keep operating through November. Now, this was on October 23rd, so they gave them about 5 weeks to be able to operate. And additionally, it states that the U.S. holds about 80% of the arrears owed by all 159 member nations. So it is the United States and the United States alone that is preventing the United Nations from being able to effectively do anything. Additionally, he talks a little bit about Kosovo and that before the U.S. became leaders, the Europeans just kept murdering each other left and right. Now, it is my contention that rather than having the Europeans murder each other, the past 54 years has just been marked by the United States murdering everybody else. There's no reason to assume that people cannot come together and discuss issues. The problem is that the United States, even when they try to negotiate, has too much self-interest and cannot effectively negotiate anything because they go in and say, here's what you do. If you don't abide by all of the standards that we're going to set out, we're going to bomb you. I would not call that negotiation. I don't know if anyone can possibly call that negotiations. It would have to be a completely broad term of what negotiations are. And for those reasons, I believe that the United States should not maintain its position as the cop of the world and the rogue superpower of the world.
Have you ever heard of the Berlin Wall and the Iron Curtain?
Heard of the Berlin Wall. Heard of the Iron Curtain.
How many people from Western Europe tried to get in East? And how many people tried to get in West? How many Cubans got up this morning in Miami and said, we've got to get out of this rogue republic back to the paradise of Santa? How would we stop Adolf Hitler?
First, I would not advocate that we all sing Kumbaya, although that might be a beneficial thing for society as a whole, it's not going to solve all of our international problems. Secondly, I can't give you exact numbers of how many people are crossing over borders, how many people want to be part of the United States, but the contention that I would make is if they do want to be part of the United States, it's because of the large propaganda machine that the media and the government fuels in order to make us think that we live in a true democracy where in actuality that is a completely false election.
How would you have stopped with your policies to follow without American problems? Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, and Saddam Hussein. Just those three.
Okay. Well, first on, I am not the only person, I don't want to be the one to be making decisions for the international community.
Okay, we should be the
okay. Right. I think we should, first of all, we need to keep in mind with Hitler that not only did the United States not do anything, but Europe did not do anything either to stop him. Hitler even admitted that if anyone would have put political pressure on him from the beginning, he would have backed down. And so at that point, it's obvious to assume that if any other of the European nations would have tried to put pressure on Hitler and stop him from committing these atrocities, then that would have been successful and dictate the United States of the power to stop us.
But the other powers wouldn't do it.
But the United States would not do it until we were bombed in Pearl Harbor. When did we get involved? Not until direct attack against us.
You just made the argument for the United States being the world's police. Thank you.
All right. There are two issues in this debate. One is how do we balance power and protect security and peace on the planet Earth? And secondly, is this UN hypothetical hypothesis option presented by our good friends on the left? First, in 1790, to be prepared for war is one of the most effectual ways of preserving the peace. George Washington said that in 1790, and thus this republic was formed. Now, I would like to go line by line on the arguments and the emotionally packed invalid figures that are presented to you on the left about race and mass deaths and what have you. First, as conceded by Professor Miller, the United Nations receives the vast majority of its funding from the United States, and if you look at its track record, the U.S. military has acted every single time. My question to you, my friend, is where is the alternative force when we need it? It's not in Eastern Europe, it's not in Western Europe, it's not in Japan or China. It is here in the 50 states. The League of Nations, a template to this UN, was started at the beginning of this century. It didn't work. Americans, the U.S. didn't sign on to it because they weren't willing to cast their military into an ambiguous model that this side is arguing for. And tying into that, their argument about resources and profit and we're extorting the third world or the developing world, as they like to call it, I'd like to ask you a question. How many of you in this room are willing to give up your cars and your computers and these cameras and these lights and your ability to come to this education and willing to give this up to go along with their model? Now, they talk about chains in America now. Can you imagine how many chains there would be without our military? It's just not feasible. Let's look at the UN success rate. They say, let's democratize the UN. In May of 1948, 48 hours after the state of Israel became independent, the Arab nations attacked Israel. The UN did nothing. In Korea, the United States preserved the democratic South Korea, and along the argumentation of my esteemed partner here, how many people are jumping from North Korea to get to South Korea, to Seoul, where the Olympics have been held? Vietnam. You look at Vietnam. The UN did nothing. The French pulled out. So what was the viable balance? The United States. It was folks like this that argued against intervention in the use of military force that blurred our perspective. And as a result, we had to turn over 12 million Vietnamese to communism, and we allowed the Khmer Rouge to come into Cambodia and kill the millions that they're talking about because of a lack of U.S. presence. You look at the Gulf War. Who got Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait? Not the Kuwaitis, not Saudi Arabia, not the French, not Botswana, the United States. You look at nuclear regulation. In their model, they cite all of this threat to get you going about nuclear holocaust and controlling these weapons and disarmament. But where is the mechanism within a UN consensus of 365 countries to regulate these missiles when half of them don't have it? Haiti. Professor Miller talks about Haiti. Who, on a boat, brought Aristide back to Haiti? The United States, under Bush, reinstalled it in power. You look at the Cold War. The Cold War on the floor of the UN, when we went along with this UN model, partitioned it into the third world, the US, and the Soviet Union. Nothing got done, if you look on this fracture. So the balance by the United States is the only viable option, and this is why. They say that the US ignores other countries' interests, yet they concede that we currently train troops in 80 different countries. If you want a police force that's accountable to the indigenous population, there's one example. Second, the amount of foreign aid we've given to Russia, to Africa, when President Bush sent military intervention into Somalia to feed those people and to restore some balance in there, came from us. Where else is it going to come from? They say that, argue that the U.S. is a proponent of colonialism. I don't see anywhere in our record, in our current record, currently as we stand here, that we're pursuing a policy of colonization across the globe. And so what you need to look at, and you really need to ask yourself this, are you willing, and I know some of you stood up and clapped, but you say that as you drive around in your cars and pursue your education here and talk on your cell phones and use your internet and film this and wear your clothes and look at the electricity. How many of you are willing to trade places with individuals in Kosovo, in Somalia? How many of you are willing to cast our military over to the hands of the People's Republic of China, which has systematically wiped out the Tibetans, and let them run the show? Or how many of you are willing to take our military, our resources, and the current balance we have and send it to the floor of a General Assembly, which I have cited 8 major instances where they did nothing, has never successfully militarily intervened. How many of you are willing to put your eggs in that basket so we can sit around and talk and have Nelson Mandela be a mediator? Come on, a mediator, has a mediator worked in Kosovo? Please tell me if they have, because I don't think so. We've had to take refugees all over the place. It's a nice thought, it's an ideal thought, and I leave you with this. In international relations, when you look at the system, international law It's lipserve. It's a horizontal system. All states determine their interests based on them. There is no, like in a domestic system where there's a president or a law system, a vertical system. It's a horizontal system. Their model cannot account for security or for dialogue in a horizontal system where countries are going to pursue different interests. If we can't, in the last 54 years, Professor Miller, establish a consensus vote on the UN Security Council, what makes you think that we're going to be able to do one under your model, even if we change the whole thing and have Nelson Mandela, Jimmy Carter, and Willie Nelson sitting there? I mean, it's just not viable. Now, lastly, when the world practiced isolationism, when Adolf Hitler came to power, he had written a book, Mein Kampf. He wrote and said and did what he meant. Neville Chamberlain and the United States practiced the policy of appeasement, isolationism. What happened? It spiraled into the Second World War. 6 million Jews would be annihilated in this war. 12 million Russians. 15 million Japanese. For waiting to talk for isolationism, that's not the answer. Does our military, does our foreign policy have some flaws? Yes. Any policy has flaws. But at least you have a record to look with our model. Their record is nothing but 8 consecutive world defeats. Thank you.
Okay, the first question I want to ask you deals with this Hitler analogy that you keep bringing in, thinking that this is the key area to show our why we should be a leader. Now, is your argument that if Europe intervened against Hitler and the United States did not, then these problems would have still ensued?
I have always been and will always be a proponent of acting sooner is better than acting later, as World War II and World War I show us. So yes, okay. We should act decisively, immediately, with clear goals. Not this consensus approach you're talking about. We all get in a room and we sit down and we toast.
Okay, do you think that it would have been prudent in World War II for everyone to have a consensus to stop Hitler? Right? I don't understand why the U.S. has to take a leading role in that to stop Hitler. Why couldn't the European nations do that?
Because they didn't. They couldn't, because there's no consensus on along the model you're arguing. France and Britain sat around as Hitler waged war. And
along with the United States sitting around, they all sat around, right? So
and your analysis
it just
on that...
Seems to make an argument
you actually,
out of it.
No, you actually make the argument for us, because by saying that, you actually illustrate that isolationism is invalid.
Okay.
So thank you for
you're
that.
Welcome. The next argument I want to... The next argument I want to talk to you is you make a good appeal to this audience to tell them they need to give up everything.
As you do,
Mike. You say they need to give up everything if the U.S. stops its role as the global police force, the road superpower. I don't see the analogy. There's telling everybody?
You want me to show you the analogy?
Or is your analogy that someone's just going to drop the bomb on us?
Yeah, let me, okay. Can I give you the analogy?
No, that's good. Someone's going to drop the bomb on us?
No, what's going to happen is you're going to send these people, protective force, the United States military, into some ambiguous structure. We have no defense to protect our interests.
Which goes to the next area of questioning.
Sure.
I want to talk to you about the UN. Now, you keep inciting the effectiveness of the UN.
Yeah. Ineffectiveness is the key word in bold letters.
Right. The UN currently is ineffective. Right. Now, the question I have for you is that being that the United States has put in more vetoes in the Security Council than any other
nation. Not true. The Soviet Union and France always managed to, plant.
Okay, so you're proving my point even more as to
I'm actually illustrating to these good people that consensus is impossible among five members, and you want to do consensus around
See, this is where clarification needs to be made. Now,
yes, clarify it, because
how does the general assembly work now? It's based on vote and the majority wins, right? So why does there need to be a consensus? If there's 365 nations, they could take a vote just as Congress and the majority would win, right?
No.
Whatever the majority decides is what would happen. They don't 365
nations. Let's put your consensus away and stick with the U.S. balance of power, which works, because you haven't answered the fact that the U.N. is ineffective. Thank you.
In closing, let us reiterate some of the themes that Robert eloquently and I less eloquently have raised in this debate. Are we better off in the previous 54 years of this century of the United States acting as the world's policeman than we were the first 45 years of this century when we did not. Without American power, Adolf Hitler would be ruling the world. Without American power, the evil empire of Lenin, Stalin, Khrushchev, and Brezhnev would be ruling the world. Without American power, Saddam Hussein would be in downtown Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, dominating the world's oil supply, using the revenues for weapons of mass destruction, and threatening Israel with the second major gassing of this century that could turn into a Holocaust. With American power, that hasn't happened. With American power, an imperial Japan has become a peaceful, prosperous, democratic Japan. With American power, Germany is peaceful, prosperous, and democratic. Not all American allies are democratic, but virtually every democracy that was worth its salt during the Cold War, but for India, was an American ally. Certainly, we did make mistakes during the Cold War. No policy is perfect, but as philosopher Karl Popper puts it, the search for the perfect is the enemy of the good, and American prophylactic commitments and credibility has been very, very, very good indeed for millions and millions of people in the world. There is, in short, no substitute for an American power. We take it for granted in this age of freedom and prosperity that it comes free, that it will last no matter what we do, that it's impervious to destruction. It's not. It took World War I, World War II, and the Cold War to build it. Let's not squander what the World War II generation did for us and the freedom we have now. The alternative to American leadership, make no mistake, is a descent into Habesian chaos in the world where life will be, for too many people, nasty, solitary, brutish, and short. Let us instead march together and make sure that the United States military remains strong. The problem today is not that we have too many weapons, but we can't afford the build-down that has happened in the 90s with our responsibilities. Let us therefore restore American military power, which is the greatest solvent for peace and prosperity in the annals of human history and endeavor. American weakness will invite tyranny. As Samuel Huntington points out in his seminal books on the subject, American power has expanded the zone of peace consistent with our ideals and self-interest, and the ideals and self-interest of hundreds of millions around the globe. I therefore defend unequivocally, without apology, that the United States has to be the world's global policeman, because anything else is going to be fundamentally worse.
Well, it's hardly not being this sort of such a collection of cliche and misrepresentations, but let me start out by suggesting that the model we're advocating is not the U.S. as it now stands, sabotaged by the undemocratic Security Council in which the permanent members have veto votes, and the U.S. has passed more veto than the other nation, so the Soviets came close to catching up at a certain period. What we're arguing for is the United Nations stripped of the Security Council, and having only the General Assembly, and then having decisions made on the basis of majority rule, not consensus. So we don't need to struggle for unanimity, though it would be nice if we could achieve that. All we need to do is let democracy function, something that the U.S. has been historically opposed to in the U.N., since determining democracy is the real nature of U.S. foreign policy, not spreading it. So that's the model we're arguing for, and that involves a radical restructuring of the United Nations. The Reagan administration began the policy of systematically dismantling the United Nations. The news item that Justin mentioned is a news item that was published 3 months before the U.S. went to war against Iraq under the U.N. Banner, and that was, I think, a monument to the blackmail that the U.S. carried out against the U.N. for bringing out Iraq. By the way, most people don't yet know that in 1990, The U.S. ambassador, April Glaspie, met with Saddam Hussein 2 weeks before the invasion of Kuwait, and she told him that we had no stake in defending Kuwait, that it was an Arab-Arab conflict that he was free to do what he wanted. That was a classic case of incitement, which then gave George Bush the excuse to put 500,000 troops in the Persian Gulf and control the world. Both Germany and Japan are chief economic competitors in the present and the future. There were a number of claims made about the U.S. Stopping Hitler. A Vietnam vet friend of mine in a debate here a few years ago pointed out that if you had amnesia about what happened in 1945, how the war ended, and you traveled the third world, the free world, you'd think the Nazis had won the war from the number of military dictatorships and fascist regimes installed and supported and aided by the United States. U.S. policy is not to spread democracy. Democracies tend to use their resources for their own population instead of making their economies subordinate to the needs of U.S. multinational corporations. Democracies are dangerous, and it's an anti-democratic stance that our opposition is taking here in arguing that the U.S. should act unilaterally and use its force to maintain the present structure of things. A recent study was done about distribution of wealth. 83% of the world's wealth is in the hands of the top 20% of the world's population. 5.4% of the wealth is in the hands of the bottom 60%. That's a legacy of 500 years of colonialism, and we need to forget that when we talk about working out a more equitable division of resources, because whether we like it or not, the future is in jeopardy with that kind of maldistribution, not to mention the ecological devastation that's accompanied it. Briefly, it was mentioned that we should have acted sooner against Hitler and the Holocaust. The ruling class in the United States supported Hitler until the invasion of Poland in 1939. He was seen as bringing order to Germany. They supported the fascists in Italy as well. The U.S. was asked by European Jews refugees to take refugees as early as 1942, and the U.S. refused. The U.S. was asked to bomb the railheads that were being used by the Nazis to transport European Jews and other victims of the Holocaust to the concentration camps. The U.S. and the Allies refused to bomb those railheads until the very end of the war, and then it's not clear that that was the way of covering themselves. Haiti and Aristide. The U.S. funded the military that drove Haiti, that drove Aristide out of Haiti. While he was kept here for 3 years, that military decapitated the lawless movement that he led, so by the time we finally allowed him to return, Haiti had been rendered safe again. What we have here is in effect a sort of distortion of the nature of the U.S. record in order to make the unacceptable look acceptable. In terms of the current situation in Kosovo, the Rambouillet Accords weren't accords. They were an outright form of extortion. The U.S. said, either accept 25,000 foreign troops on your soil or we'll bomb you. They knew it was an unacceptable ultimatum, and they knew that bombing would fall. I think we need to rethink the nature of U.S. imperialism and take back control of our own government.